I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum present today. Just to go through a few items that we say every time before our hearing. Everyone today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any accommodations, please let staff know. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table and should be left outside. Clapping and disruptions are not allowed. And additionally, those who have signed up in advance have been provided with time limits, and members of the public who choose to testify will also be provided with a time limit. We actually don't have any testifiers signed up for today, so I don't think we'll need to worry about that. Before we get started with our agenda, we need approval of the March 20th, 2024 minutes. Representative Mueller, Representative Grossel.
He's
ready. He's got it in his hand. May I have that motion, please?
So moved.
All right. Representative Grossel moves approval of the minutes for March 20th, 2024. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 20th, 2024 are approved. We are shaking things up a little bit already. We've got House File 3725. It's a Representative Wolgamott bill. I will move to lay over House File 3725. I don't see any amendments, Representative Wolgamott. Your bill is before us, so please go ahead and explain your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and Lead Novotny and members of the Public Safety Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to present House File 3725, which is a bill to include correctional officers in Minnesota Statute 626.89 by extending the Peace Officer Bill of Rights to non-licensed correctional officers in order to provide those officers with the same protections as licensed police officers. That is the bill, and with that, Madam Chair, I have a testifier to further shed light on the importance of House File 3725.
All right, and we have Mark Schneider. Hopefully that is who you are.
It is.
All right, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Schneider, and I am General Counsel at Law Enforcement Labor Services. Law Enforcement Labor Services is the largest public safety union in the state of Minnesota. We represent over 7,000 members throughout the state, north, south, east, and west. We are not limited to the metro area. As part of our obligations and duties as the public safety union, we represent our members, who include firefighters, licensed peace officers, dispatchers, and non-licensed correctional officers. The matter now before this committee concerns Representative Wolgamott's House File 3725. Just by way of history and a little bit of background, as you're aware, under Minnesota Statute 179A, the Public Employment Labor Relations Act, the legislature has determined that given the nature of public employment and its relationship to take care of the welfare, health, and well-being of the public, there are certain protections in PELRA. That is the statute that governs the rights and obligations of public employers vis-a-vis the public employees. And importantly, the legislature has already indicated that it's important to establish special rights, responsibility, procedures, and limitations regarding public employment relationships, which will provide for the protection of the rights of the public employee, the public employer, and the public at large. In 1994-95, PODPA 626.8829 was enacted by the legislature in order to ensure that licensed peace officers are provided the opportunity, prior to an investigation of alleged misconduct, that they obtain notice of what that allegation is, that they are allowed union representation or counsel prior to that interview and at that interview, along with other notice rights. In 2005, the legislature passed CODPA. That is the bill that deals with non-licensed correctional officers. Correctional officers in our membership stand side by side with licensed peace officers in many jails and correctional facilities throughout the state of Minnesota. They run the same risks, they're under the same dangers, and they're under the same obligations and responsibility as their licensed counterparts. As a result, Representative Wolgamott has brought before you a bill to fold correctional officers, non-licensed correctional officers, into the protections afforded under the PODPA statute, the Peace Officers Discipline Procedures Act. Interestingly, what we're seeing out there, We're seeing an uptick in internal affairs investigations, and not necessarily because there's an increase in misconduct, but the awareness and the public awareness has been heightened, and maybe understandably so. But as part of that process, it's important that employers treat their employees fairly and properly, as outlined in PODPA and outlined in CODPA and outlined more, maybe more importantly, in PELRA, which is the public union statute that not only deals with peace officers, correctional officers, but teachers, et cetera. It's kind of the lifeblood of our state. You know, it's the DFL, Democratic Farm Labor Party. Labor is important no matter what your position is, no matter how you're viewed by the public. There are still rights that are necessary and that are part of the legislative fiber right now that we are seeking to ensure remain for all peace officers. We're also asking, or as part of the bill, there's an amendment regarding the definition of formal statement. A formal statement currently is defined as either a stenographic, tape recorded, or other type of memorialization of that statement. We're asking for an expansion just of that definition to include whenever an employer seeks information from either a licensed peace officer and a correctional officer about a situation or a concern, that be considered a formal statement in order to trigger the rights under PODPA and CODPA. I can speak from experience that currently several employers are not recording statements or recording interviews, but they're calling individuals in order to discuss with them with the possibility of discipline, but they're not triggering the PODPA or CODPA rights. And that is a concern, it's a problem. What we're asking for is just fairness and due process in order to ensure that not only PODPA, CODPA rights are protected, but that the PELRA rights and policies are also continued in order to protect the public employees who protect us.
All right, thank you for your testimony, and there were a lot of acronyms there, but it was very clear. So PODPA, CODPA, PELRA, we got it.
Yeah, there won't be a test.
So all right.
It took me 30 years to figure it out. So, but I do appreciate this opportunity. It's my honor to represent those over 7,000 public employees in Minnesota, and we certainly appreciate your consideration here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Not seeing that, we can move on to member discussion. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testimony. I got a couple of questions, but the first one is, if we put this into law, what protections will now be afforded that do not exist?
Mr. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Frazier. The protections that will be put into law that currently do not exist, at least in terms of correctional officers, and as part of our written materials that were submitted for the committee's consideration, that there is a spreadsheet. But the most important ones that I would say would be a summary of allegations, a signed complaint of misconduct, a summary of allegations provided to the particular employee, the right to identify witnesses or other evidence that may be used against them at an administrative hearing. These are already rights afforded to licensed peace officers. And so my position is, and I think reasonably, is that there would be no further burden on public employers should these rights be expanded or afforded to correctional officers.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. You mentioned due process a couple of times, and you gave a scenario of having statements and then bringing individuals back in to discuss those statements that could potentially lead to discipline.
Yes, sir.
My question is, don't Weingarten rights apply? These are union members. They're protected by PELRA. Weingarten rights don't apply there?
Mr. Schneider.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frazier, Weingarten would trigger when an employee has a reasonable belief that they will be subject to discipline. What we're seeing out there with certain employers is that the sergeant will come in, a supervisor will come in and say, hey, I want to talk to you. Come into my office right here, right now. As you may know, many members may not be aware of Weingarten rights, or when they're directed or ordered by a supervisor to come and talk to them, that is an order. It's not a request. It's not a favor. and they need to abide by that chain of command. They could trigger Weingarten rights and request for union representation, but yet we're still missing the summary of allegations or a signed complaint. There's no notice to that employee why they're being called into that supervisor's office. And that's the problem.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Frazier. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgemont, for bringing this. You know, we've all had the opportunity to tour various correctional facilities over the course of this term and obviously talk to the folks who staff them. And I think the one takeaway that we would all agree to is that these are places that lie in the shadows of our day-to-day consciousness. And for that reason, we sometimes don't fully appreciate the scope of the work that our corrections personnel are doing. And the fact that, really, when you compare it to peace officers outside, they're subject to the sort of tension that might only exist at a call, for instance, but they're subject to that tension of possibility all the time throughout their entire shift. And so I appreciate the fact that we're recognizing the role that they play, the critical role that they play in our criminal justice system, and that we're taking some efforts to recognize that. Thank you.
All right. Anything further? No? All right. Representative Wolgemont, any closing comments?
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair, and Lead Novotny and members of the committee for the opportunity to present House File 3725. I ask for your support in enhancing public safety in Minnesota by ensuring that adequate protections and due process exists for both correctional officers and licensed peace officers. I ask for your support for House File 3725. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lee Novotny. Thank you, members.
Thank you. I renew the motion and lay over House File 3725. Thanks again for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're going to move next to Representative Ween's bill. It is House File 3304, and I will move that House File 3304 be placed on the General Register. First, thank you for bringing us treats this morning, Representative Weens. They were delicious.
This is his first time.
And so you got your bill moved up in order. No, it's not because of the treats.
More of those.
Yeah. So I will move that House File 3304 be placed on the General Register, and I see that you have the A1 amendment. I will also move the A1 amendment. Please tell us about your A1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'm Representative Mark Weens, House District 41 Alpha, that's serving the good people of Washington County. Thank you, and please enjoy the Danish almond kringler. Hopefully that bodes well for this bill. Yeah, House File 3304, Amendment A1, really just aligns with the right dating. It started last year, so it's changing it to 2024.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Now your bill as amended is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just by way of note, the companion bill in the Senate, carried by Senator Howe, has passed through committee and is now on the Senate floor on the General Register. So that's a good note in the other House. And also there's a the fiscal note came back, and it is zero cost. So that's a good news thing for this. This bill, it's a companion to a bill we passed last year, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. And that bill and act really filled a gap for our veterans that live outside of a place where there's a veterans treatment court. And I've got Judge Carey here, and he'll talk a little bit about his experience in Ramsey County, the veterans treatment court, so that you see where the parallels are. Again, the VRJA passed through last year. It is law. It passed in the Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus Bill. However, it did not have metrics with it. This bill that I'm carrying is to satisfy what I would consider the need to know. The VRJA is a diversion program that assists our veterans with a service-connected issue to restore them to our communities. Typically, this is related to either a mental health or a substance abuse problem that occurred in service, possibly from post-traumatic stress, military sexual trauma, or a mild traumatic brain injury. The bill that I'm carrying today, 3304, purpose is to add accountability, transparency, and effectiveness by establishing success metrics that ensure that the VRJA is delivering on its promise for veterans and for safety in our communities. The bill has two parts, two reports, I'll say. The first report is from the courts to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission on veteran offenders. The second report is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission report back to the legislature, which will be given to the chairs and leads of two committees, this committee, Public Safety, as well as Veterans Finance and Policy. Similar to the decades-old Veterans Treatment Court, which have been highly successful and have developed metrics, which ensures that our veterans are being served in our commitment and our communities are safe. You'll find in your handouts the 10 key components to a successful Veterans Treatment Court. I would highlight that number 8, which is a monitoring and evaluation, is what I'm trying to add in with this bill, 3304. And my intent is to develop these success metrics to understand how the new law is working, whether we need to make adjustments, and in the hope that it becomes successful, just as successful as our Veterans Treatment Courts. I do want to say special thanks to the co-author on this, and that's Vice Chair Feist, for her work, which has been very, I think, groundbreaking with the VRJA. I'm glad to partner with you on that. Also, special thanks to a unnamed former GOP Judiciary Senior Consultant and to a Mr. John Holtquist for his erstwhile help, as well as Mr. Ben Johnson, who really put this bill in the form that you see before here today. So thank you to all of those folks. And today I have two testifiers, if I can just enter those, Madam Chair. I'm accompanied today by the Honorable Judge Carey, who presides over the Ramsey County Veterans Treatment Court. He comes from the 2nd Judicial District, and also Mr. Ryan Elsie, a legal advocate for the Veterans Defense Project, advocating for deferred veterans journeying through the VRJA process. So,
all right, welcome to the committee, Judge Timothy Carey. Please introduce yourself again for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Carey. I am a judge in the 2nd Judicial District in Ramsey County. I have the honor and privilege to preside over the Veterans Treatment Court, the Mental Health Treatment Court.
And if you could, the mic may, I don't know where the mic is. Can you put it up a little? There you go. Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
I do preside over the treatment court, or two of the treatment courts in Ramsey County, including Veterans Treatment Court. Our process is that a number of assessments are determined, are completed when a person is referred from a general criminal court calendar to determine whether a person has the needs to participate in the program. We are a multidisciplinary team, so every time we have a court calendar on a weekly basis, we meet. It's a prosecutor, a defense lawyer, a treatment provider, a probation officer, and a person who's a participant a treatment coordinator with a VA. We come together and we talk about things that have happened with the veteran since the last time that we were all together. The beginning, it's a very labor-intensive court for the participants and the justice partners. The people who participate have to submit to very frequent screens, observed screens, to make sure that they're not using drugs or alcohol, or to understand the extent to which those chemicals are being used. We consistently check in with the treatment providers and talk to them about how the person's doing. We adjust in real time based on the number of appearances and the amount of information that we have from so many different people. This process allows us to weed out situations where maybe probation is being triangulated against the treatment staff. We all sit at the table together, we share information, and we make decisions based on public safety and treatment needs. The assessment tools that are used to determine a person's eligibility and progress through the five phases of treatment towards graduation are evidence-based, so it's research supports the determination that these factors are correlated with risk and need for treatment. And the response is that because this is a nationwide model, we have a lot of data about what works and what does not work for people based on their cluster of either mental health or substance use or employment or social issues. We have that body of information that helps us guide decisions so that when we do pivot based on some change in the person's life, we're going in the right direction to help them succeed and help keep the community safe.
All right, thanks for your testimony. And then I have Ryan Elsie also signed up to testify. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Ryan Elsie, E-L-S-E. I am a criminal defense lawyer, a policy attorney for the Veterans Defense Project, and I'm a veteran myself. I was honored to be able to be part of passing the VRJA, and it has been such a success. It drew national attention. We were recruited to serve on the Veterans Justice Commission, which was chaired by Secretaries Chuck Hagel and Leon Panetta. It then became the model bill under ALEC. And the one part that we don't have here in Minnesota that ALEC recommends and the Justice Commission recommended is data collection, so we know how the model is serving veterans and where it can be improved. Therefore, I've been pushing for some sort of data collection since we started this, and it would be really great to see it moving forward. I practice in veterans courts across the state, and I can tell you that anecdotally, I've seen the dockets expand massively. Anoka now has three separate dockets that they have to serve because they don't have enough room in the courtroom for all the veterans that are coming in. So it's doing good work, and thank you for considering this bill.
All right, thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anybody from the public who wishes to testify? Okay, I'm not seeing that. I believe there might be an oral amendment on a technical issue that Ben Johnson has pointed out. So, Mr. Johnson, to you.
Madam Chair, members, this is a very technical, small change. This particular language was drafted last year. During session last year, this committee passed and the legislature ultimately passed some revisions to the VRJA language. As a result, there's an internal cross-reference that is incorrect and needs to be updated. The amendment would be page 1, line 9, delete paren D, close paren, and insert paren B, close paren. That's all.
All right, any discussion to that oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Oppose? The motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. We didn't have any other members of the public who wish to testify, so we can move on now to member discussions. Vice Chair Feist. I looked right at you because I knew you were going to say something, as you should.
Thank you. Before I get to my general comments, if we're making oral amendments, I know we had talked about adding a temporal aspect to page 2, line 2.16, where we talk about number of people who have committed a technical violation of probation. Maybe this is too complicated to do as an oral amendment, but the idea was that there should be some sort of time period that that refers to. And Mr. Johnson can let me know if that's just too complicated to do on the fly. Too complicated?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, do you have a particular proposal?
You know what? This is too complicated to do. I thought you would have a proposal. Yeah, we can just do it. I'll just talk more generally.
Perfect. Go
well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Representative Weens, for bringing this bill. It's been a pleasure working with you on this and talking about it with you over the past year. Everyone on this committee knows I'm kind of into restorative justice, and that started with the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, and Representative Eklund had worked for many years on it and brought me into the loop, and I've just been truly inspired by what restorative justice can do and what our treatment courts do. So I also am a fan of data, and so I just think this is a really good move, and it will allow us to really understand the impact, and I'm working on other legislation just to, like, really support our treatment courts more broadly, and I feel like this is just going to be really helpful in making sure we can do that strategically. So thank you for bringing this bill. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Weens, for following up on what we talked about on the floor. I always love to see that when you know, great ideas come to fruition. I think this is a really good, bill. I'm really excited by it. I had a question when you were doing your introduction. It sparked a thought for me. You mentioned that some of the folks who enter into these proceedings have mild brain injury or head trauma. Do we track what brings people in, and do we track that information?
I'm going to defer to the judge on the Veterans Treatment Court, but I'll just say this comment. To go into this program as well as the Veterans Treatment Court, you have to have a service-connected issue, and typically what spawns those are maybe a mild traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain exactly what the Veterans Treatment Court does if it has that. I'm pretty certain they have access to that.
Judge Carey.
Thank you. Yes, we certainly have a full diagnostic completed, and all of the treatment efforts are centered around is it like a diagnosis like schizophrenia or bipolar, or is it a depression plus some substance use disorder plus a brain injury. So all of those elements are on the table and consistently reviewed based on responses to treatment interventions, maybe any relapses or any other destabilizing factors related to housing or family situations.
Representative Hollins, anything else?
No, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Further member discussion? Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and I just wanted to say real briefly thank you to Representative Weens for all the work that you do in support of veterans across Minnesota. I see the work that you're doing, and I see your passion. I just wanted to note that on the record, and thank you.
All right. I don't see anybody else raising their hand, so we can move on to closing remarks. Representative Weens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. This is just the first step. As Mr. Else mentioned, there's other data we want to have, and I think there will be subsequent amendments and bills that will make this even better. Just in closing, thank you. I just request your support for House File 3304 and for supporting our veterans and our communities in their restoration. Thank you.
Thank you. And I will renew the motion that House File 3304, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again to the testifiers as well. We're going to now move to Representative Berg's bill, House File 2609. I will move to lay over House File 2609. There is a DE1 amendment. I will also move the DE1 amendment, and because it is a complete DE, I think it makes sense to adopt the DE, and then you can describe the bill. Any discussion to the DE amendment? All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The DE1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Berg, your bill as amended is before us. Please explain your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Today we have an opportunity and a tremendous responsibility before us. Together, we can choose to continue to build on the hard work that members of this committee, members on both sides of the aisle, and those that came before us in our efforts to learn, to evolve, and to take collective action to keep our communities safe. I'd like to ground us in the values that called each of us into public service as we engage into this discussion. So, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present House File 2609. Last month in my community and our law enforcement and emergency management services community suffered a tremendous loss. It was shocking and horrible, and the lives of many families were torn apart that day. What we have come to find out through the preliminary investigation that led to the indictment is that the assailant had lost his gun rights in 2007 after being convicted of a felony assault. As we all know now, there were multiple guns in the home, and the AR-15-style weapons that were used against the first responders should not have been in possession of the assailant. One AR-15-style gun was equipped with a binary trigger that, as the indictment states, fires one shot when the trigger is pulled and another when the trigger is released, effectively doubling the rate of fire. As we have learned, the use of such a trigger essentially creates an automatic weapon which does not allow for any type of defense to be mounted. Last week's federal indictment of the assailant's girlfriend alleges that she knew or should have known that that assailant could not legally possess a firearm. While strap purchases are already illegal under Minnesota law, our law contains loopholes that need to be closed in order to hold offenders accountable. House File 2609, as amended, does the following. It makes the Minnesota straw purchase law effective by requiring that the purchaser know or reasonably should know that the transferee is a prohibited person. This makes the standard consistent with federal law. In addition, it closes a loophole in current law that only prohibits straw purchasing for certain types of firearms. Our bill will prohibit straw purchasing for all firearms. The bill also moves the crime of straw purchasing from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. The bill requires the BCA to do a report on gun trafficking. And third, the bill bans binary triggers on guns. This bill is one more step we can take in addition to other actions taken by this committee to keep our families and law enforcement safe from gun violence. Gun violence requires a multifaceted response, and this bill closes loopholes in current laws in order to hold offenders accountable. I am proud to carry this bill. I hope you will all join me in supporting it. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will stand for questions.
All right, and we did not have anybody sign up in advance to testify. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any. So we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg. I'm just a little curious regarding the thought process behind this bill. So as is a matter of record, the minority attempted to declare an urgency on the House floor recently to pass the bulk of what you've presented before us today, which is the piece regarding enhanced penalties for straw purchases. So obviously we're for that. What's the rationale in inserting the language in line 217, adding what appears to be targeted at binary triggers, that would be devices that fire two shots, one upon the pull of a trigger and one upon the release of a trigger. What's your thinking there in terms of the relevance to that, to the straw purchasing piece?
Representative Berg.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. The two are related, as we saw from the incident in my community. And so the thought process behind a binary trigger, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, is that it takes any type of firearm, once it's modified or comes with a binary trigger, from the one motion of depressing the trigger and the bullet comes out to there being one motion where it releases the bullet on the way out and as you pull your finger back. And so, as mentioned, it turns a firearm into a semi-automatic or automatic state.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, for that answer. I'm not sure I still understand what the thematic connection is between those two things. I just don't understand why we couldn't. If we obviously agree on the increasing penalties for straw purchases piece, which was made evident by our declaration of an urgency earlier on in the session, I don't know why we couldn't just have a clean bill that affects that rather than attaching a potentially controversial gun control piece of legislation to it as well. Thank you.
Any further member discussion? Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the connection, Representative Berg, please help me with this, or one connection besides just the need to do more regarding gun violence, is that in the situation in your community, the tragic situation, there was a straw purchase, which is being federally indicted, but also the use of, as I gather, a binary trigger. I may be wrong about that. Can you just help me understand that?
Representative Berg.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. So the firearm that was straw purchased from the store, which is also in my district, was done by the assailant's girlfriend, and it came with the binary trigger. And so that mechanism is what turns a relatively normal firearm into a firearm that has the capacity to be used like an automatic weapon. And because of that, it gave no time for our first responders to mount a reaction and to further protect themselves from what happened. And so that's why it's essential that as we learn, we evolve and we can take solid action to protect our communities and our first responders.
Follow up.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. And Representative Berg, because what I recall hearing is that the officers thought that there was an automatic weapon being used, and it turned out it was this binary trigger, sort of adding the so really so much more dangerous. So I guess I would hope this provision. I don't know that I would have thought would have occurred to me that this provision would be controversial. In fact, we banned automatic weapons, and this is something where actually those first responders thought that was being used against them. And maybe I'll just comment that I also really appreciate the and this was an improvement on the bill that was under consideration on the House floor, is the addition at the bottom of page 2 of saying that not only is straw purchase you're increasing to a felony, but also the addition of if you reasonably know that the person is ineligible. And I had said on the House floor that the current law, the way it's written, it's almost impossible to charge. You really have to have a situation like in Burnsville where there's like text messages and everything else. And at that point, it's charged federally, which it was. So this will make it be much more. If you reasonably should know that the person is ineligible as a dangerous felon, then you should not be transferring a gun to them. So really appreciate you putting all this together. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Rep. Berg, for bringing this forward. And I just wanted to note, too, that I definitely see the relationship between the different components of this bill. Just if, from the perspective of we're looking at what situations will make the use of a firearm more dangerous. And two of those things are implementing a mechanism that makes it automatic. And another thing that makes a weapon more dangerous is whose hands you put it in. And so I see that these are absolutely related, and I just want to thank you for your work on this.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg. I just want to say, first of all, I applaud you for bringing the bill. I do think it's the right thing to do in this moment. I've spoken with you multiple times. I've spoken with impacted community members multiple times. And I know that your community is grieving. This is a tragedy. We're not far removed from it yet. And I think it takes a strong leader to come through with clarity and thoughtfulness in terms of how to address the issue to ensure that it doesn't happen again. I think this bill does that. I appreciated your opening statement. I saw how you had to collect yourself because of what you're going through right now and what your community's going through. And I just applaud your efforts as a strong leader to bring this bill forward.
Further member discussion, Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Berg. I know these are difficult times, and throughout it all, I tried to bring something forward, not using politics, and it's been used as getting politicized, and that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to look at incidents that happen, just like we have in previous ones, and hopefully prevent them from happening. So thank you. My one question to you is, thank you for taking the hand of Representative Bennett, Scott, on the urgency. She said if someone would take that bill, and you brought it forward. Did you reach out to her and see if you guys could have worked together on that? I think we've seen in this body, when we work together on the SRO bills or other things, we saw it yesterday with Representative Wogelman and Representative Igoe. I think they come together stronger because I think we're all coming from the same place. I don't think it's one side or the other. I think we're unified. I think that's what we're trying to do here. I guess my hope would have been that you reached out, and so I just asked that question. Thank you.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, and thank you for the question and for everything that you did for our community when you served. I am going to be honest, I did not reach out, and likely a mistake on my part, but here's what I did do. As we learned from the indictment, what we were looking at, what happened in our community, how did this happen? We learned so much. It was incredibly important to do this and to do it quickly. I will tell you, I focused on my community. I called my mayor. I called my fire chief. I spoke to members close to the situation whose anonymity I won't betray. I watched hours of alarming videos. I read gun culture threads. I wanted to come here today and do two things. Engage all of us to pass meaningful and effective legislation with a nod to the service that you provided, Lead Novotny, Representative Curran, those of you that do this every day, for our families that will never be the same, for our communities that deserve us to do that. And I wanted to do so honoring my community. I promise to keep politics out of it. I will stand in my integrity in that today. So thank you for the question.
Representative Witte. And I'll just note, Representative Rothfeld, former law enforcement, too. She's not on our committee, so I don't think it was intentional. Representative Witte.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. I am supportive of the straw buyer part of this, but I will stand with you on this because I do think I've said it before. It's great when we're there for the vigils. It's great when we're there on the day of the funerals, but 365, and I appreciate we're doing something 365. And you listened to Representative Scott, and you carried this. So thank you for getting it done.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm looking at this and just wondering to myself, why not just bring the straw purchaser bill forward? Why add this extra thing in there to kind of, to me, it mucks it up. That is something to be dealt with separately from the straw purchase, in my opinion. Why put them together?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you so much, Chair Mohler. Thank you, Representative Grossel. I did thank you for your service in the elevator. I think you thought I was weird.
No, I didn't.
Fair. That is a great question. As I mentioned, Representative Rarick's trying to teach me to handle the microphone. As I mentioned, through this chain of events, as we looked at the indictment and we learned the various different pieces that came together, which shed light and a holistic view of the situation and what we could do in response, it made sense to take the work that this committee and the Democrats and the Republicans have been working on together and to put it into a bill that we could both enact quickly and that would address the moving pieces of what we saw play out. If you recall what happened in Las Vegas when the shooter fired into a crowd of folks at a concert, that was a binary trigger. And so I don't know why we would wait any longer to enact legislation like this. And as we get the comprehensive package that begins to address the various things we've learned, it's our responsibility to do so.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you mentioned that you did not reach out to Representative Scott. Why not?
Well, I think she's already answered that question, so we're not going to go back. And actually, your first question, too, she'd already answered. So do you have any additional questions that haven't been asked yet?
Well, I guess I do, Madam Chair.
Okay,
and,
go ahead.
And that is this straw purchaser bill could have been done long before this day, should have been done long before this day, but it wasn't. And now it's pulled into again, you know, trying to limit the Second Amendment's rights to folks. And I'm, you know, it really disappoints me that we're trying to work on protecting the communities. We're trying to work on protecting our EMS, our law enforcement, and our firefighters and our paramedics. And yet the left keeps playing political games with this stuff. It saddens me when these types of things should be, the straw purchaser bill should have been done by itself. Should have been done by itself. Because we can all agree that should not be going on. I think we all do agree that should not be going on. But the part about the Second Amendment issues, those are the things that need to be hashed out separate from these types of things. And so, you know, you got one part of it right. I'm glad, the straw purchaser. But those, I don't know why we had to muck it up. Why you had to muck it up? Because this is an important deal to make sure that we protect our citizens and protect our first responders. So that's all I got on this.
And I believe Representative Hollins, you had a follow-up question.
I do. Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Berg, for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it. We're hearing that these binary triggers, adding this is mucking it up, and I was wondering if you or if someone, somebody who has expertise in this, I think we have somebody from the BCA here, could explain to me what binary triggers are used for, besides mass shootings.
So we do have somebody here from the BCA, Katie Cook, to explain what a binary trigger, perhaps how it works and what they're used for. Come on forward. And if you could introduce yourself first and then answer that question. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Katie Hook, and I work at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Forensic Science Services. I am a forensic scientist in the firearms section. So the question, what is a binary trigger? A binary trigger will discharge a cartridge upon pulling the trigger as well as releasing the trigger. And the effective purpose of that would be to double the rate of fire per trigger pull.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is not, is this something that's used in hunting?
Ms. Hook.
To my knowledge, there's no set way that you need to use a specific modification or alteration to a firearm. My understanding is that this would be mainly used for range shooting. However, when and where people are using them isn't really dictated by purchasing this specific piece.
Representative Collins.
Thank you. This is really interesting to me because I grew up around guns, and my father has many guns, and I've been a lawful gun owner for a long time, and I've never heard of this, even when I have guns for self-defense purposes. This binary trigger has never been something that I have been introduced to or exposed to, and so it's really interesting to me why for any reasonable, lawful gun owner would need to have a trigger that shoots something twice as fast. So I don't really understand how the legislation here is mucking up anything. I think this is a very reasonable restriction, and I'm glad that you brought it forward. So thank you, and thank you for your answering. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And before you leave the table, just we had others on the list, and I didn't know if they had a question for you specifically. Did anybody else have a question for her? Lee Novotny. We will come back to you again as well.
Okay. Well, my question, and since she's here, I was going to ask the question of Researcher Johnson, but when you talk about release, what is your understanding of what release means? Explain that.
I apologize. I'm not familiar with the setting. So in order to release the firing mechanism of a firearm, the trigger needs to be pulled, typically fully rearward, unless there would be some sort of modification. Releasing the trigger would be releasing pressure from the trigger. Triggers are usually manufactured with a spring that will automatically return the trigger to its resting position. So by removing the finger from the trigger would reset itself with its spring pressure.
Can you follow up on that, Lee Novotny?
Okay, just to be clear, your definition of release is to take the pressure of the finger fully off the trigger?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, and I'll address that later then.
Okay. Great. I think nobody else has further questions for you. So thank you so much for being available to help us understand that.
Thank you very much.
Next we have Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple different things. I just wanted to point out, I know Representative Pinto touched on this, but just so we're all clear, I know as conversations around this this bill came forward, you know, we're waiting for the indictment to come out so we could actually read and know more about what happened. And I think what we have here is, you know, sometimes that line between whether something is reactive and responsive versus responsive, it's not always clear exactly what's happening. But I think here we were trying to make sure that we were being responsive to what happened with the most information that we could get while still moving, you know, within our deadlines and within the parameters that we have available for us. So I really appreciate that there was at least some sort of pause to make sure that we're getting this right. You know, I noted that there was time for the county attorneys and the Sheriff's Association to weigh in and be supportive as well. And I think that's really important. And then also just wanted to make sure that it's clear for the record, and hopefully you won't mind me talking about this, Madam Chair, but we had already talked about potentially scheduling the Scott bill as we were looking at other, you know, firearm legislation that may be helpful to move forward this year, you know, before sort of the whole floor thing happened. So, you know, that was something that was already being discussed internally, and I think it's okay to share that publicly. But there are some important differences in the language in Representative Berg's language. As Representative Pinto noted, we're changing the standard to reasonably should have known instead of no. Which I think is actually really important and makes the underlying statute was not super helpful. And this makes it more usable to actually hold folks accountable when they're doing this, as well as opening it up to include, instead of limiting it to just pistols and semi-automatics, including all firearms, as we know in the incident in Burnsville, you know, not all of those firearms fell under that definition. So I think it's important to point that out, that, you know, the bill that was discussed on the House floor would not have actually prevented what happened, because it was just increasing penalties. And this is sort of the rub of why this is hard, is that it increasing the penalties only helps after the fact if a person tries to do it again. You know, if they hadn't already been on probation or weren't already charged with it previously, you know, we hope that increasing the penalties will sort of send the message that we really, really don't want you to be doing this behavior. And I think it will help to change that standard. I know I shared with you in conversation, you know, some folks are not that sophisticated, as we saw in the text messages in this case, but some folks are. And I know in the cases I've worked on where folks sort of know people who are, you know, they know where the line is and they sort of can walk up to that line to sort of maintain plausible deniability when they're you know, it's a straw purchase or some other kind of situation. So just wanted to point out, because I think it is really important that we're changing that standard and how this is different. And again, just really, I think this is the pace at which we should be reacting, you know, responding instead of, you know, immediately throwing something out there without actually doing our work to make sure that we're doing it right. So I thank you for bringing it forward, and I thank you for wading into an issue area that has not always been your expertise, but appreciate you stepping up for your community. And I think this is a good bill, and I'm happy to support it.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thanks for bringing Representative Scott's bill forward. It's important.
Bill, your microphone is really, I don't know, it seems close, but you want to scoot in a little bit.
All right. I got the computer. I have too many things going on here.
That's much better. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing Representative Scott's bill. And as we heard from already from other people that, you know, there's already been talking about putting this together. We've heard from Representative Pinto and from Becker Finn that this is different language, and Representative Witte said this is what happens when we work together. Since you wanted the language changed, did anyone go and talk to Representative Scott? If you were hoping to bring her bill forward, did anyone go and talk to Representative Scott and ask her for new language?
So that question, that's the third time.
So, no, I'm sorry.
I'm not going to send it back to her again.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that if this is something that we both agreed upon, and obviously there was language that you wanted to change, I think that we could have actually had worked with Representative Scott to do that. I want to just put my claim, my stake out there to say this is why single subject bills are so important, because we're able to come together on something that we all agree upon and with one voice say, look at, let's do something together and do it. And I know it's not the practice, and I have voted for omnibus bills too. When there are issues that we can come together, we could have brought this to the General Register today. Next week we could have brought it to the General Register, and we could have just gotten it done and really have finished it. After we made these adjustments that you wanted to be done, we could have brought this to the General Register and it would have been done. And so I appreciate that it's being laid over, because I know there's a lot of things that we still need to work out a little bit with this binary trigger. But man, I think we missed an opportunity to be able to take this language that we all agree upon, brought it to the floor, and show that we actually are going to take action on this. So thanks for bringing it forward. Hope that we're able to continue working together in the future.
Yeah, and I'll just note too, we're laying it over because this is not the Scott bill. This is Representative Berg's bill, and the Scott bill didn't have a fiscal note on it. And with the language changes that we have with this bill, with Representative Berg's bill, we requested a new fiscal note. So we want to make sure that we get that, and this committee will have the opportunity to take a look at that fiscal note before we move the bill on. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. One question that I have as I'm looking over this bill, why isn't this covered under the current trigger activator law? From my understanding, if it increases the rate of fire, it's already illegal under current law because it increases the rate to that of a machine gun. So can you explain to me how you came up with this current language and what it would also affect besides what is already in statute?
Yeah, and actually, can I take a crack at that? Because that was something that was surprising to me, Representative Ingen, when I read about the binary trigger and what it did when I read in the indictment how that worked. I went back to this law 60967, which we agreed on last year. We increased penalties for switches and bump stocks that was in this statute. So we pulled that language out again, and I read the definition of machine gun and trigger activator.
in that paragraph 1, which is on lines 2.13 to 2.15, in combination with the definition of machine gun on 2.3 to 2.4. I was actually surprised that these binary triggers are being sold by a federally licensed dealer, which to me indicates a loophole, one that we need to close. And so that's why we are specifically including those here, because apparently they are not viewing those as being forbidden under current law. Let's see, I think now we'll move on to Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. When I read the language and I saw that you added the line on 217, single pull and release of the trigger, as opposed to using the language for binary trigger from the federal statutes. And I think it was important, and I thank the expert from the VCA from coming down. As a former Glock instructor and being a firearms instructor and AR-15 instructor and armorer, we're going to need to fix this unless you want to outlaw every Glock, every modern sporting rifle that is in the state. If, by the definition provided by the BCA's expert, you have to fully release the trigger, take your finger off the trigger, this is not the same thing as what you're talking about. So we're going to need to fix this language if you want this to not make every Glock, every modern sporting firearm in violation of this statute. And by that, let me explain what I mean. These firearms have a sear that gets reset. So if you pull the trigger back, then the round goes off. If you hold that trigger back and then slowly bring it forward, there'll be a point where the sear will reset, and you need a separate action then going backward again that will drop the sear, start the firing process again. And that is not what I think what you want, as described from what the BCA agent said. So we're going to need to come up with a different definition of that, unless that's what you want. And that's a whole different issue. And I think you're talking about binary triggers, but this definition, as pointed out from the BCA agent, isn't what we're talking about. So we need to get that language cleared up. I would add several language and recording features to the first part on gun trafficking, so I appreciate that being brought forward. And then just to address some of the other things that were said, I was confused by what Chair Becker Finn said about this only applies to things afterwards, but we also want to send a message. Yes, we do want to send a message. As I said on the floor, I'd rather we didn't have these tragedies. I would rather that we didn't have these firearms being transferred to people. And one of the ways we get that message out is to have a strong penalty for those that do provide weapons to people that shouldn't have that. She also made a statement that we didn't, that we're just throwing out ideas out here. This bill, Representative Scott's bill with this exact language except what was added on, has been out there since 2019. And I think some of the frustration that Representative Grossel was pointing out was that I think it passed off the floor with pretty much unanimous support in the omnibus bill last session. So it went off the floor, and then it got lost in conference committee somehow. So as I said before, we wouldn't have been here. We wouldn't be talking about this right now if it would have stayed in the omnibus bill last session. Thank you.
And I'll just address a few of these items as well. With respect to the omnibus bill last year, you know, we did pass it off the House floor, but there never was a hearing. And so to what Chair Becker-Finn said earlier about my intent to hear Scott's bill this year, and I think a couple of you knew that I was possibly going to hear that. I was likely going to hear that. I talked to my team about it. But one of the things that has, you know, continued to come up for us was we wanted to make sure that it was effective and that reason to know standard needed to be in there. And so then when we're thinking of all of that and the indictment then came out, and we saw that, we saw the federal language, we identified additional loopholes in our statutes, the one with respect to the binary trigger, and then looking specifically again at the straw purchaser language in current law and realizing it only applies to pistols and semi-automatic military-style assault weapons. And we thought, why is it okay to be a straw purchaser for other types of firearms? That seems like a loophole that needed to be closed as well. In addition to getting more information about trafficking and lead Novotny, I'm certainly interested in what additions you think should be added to that. So please, I'm sure Representative Berg is open to those suggestions as well. Also, with respect to your suggestions with the language on binary triggers, we're open to that. And we did know that this is something that we might need to work on further. I know we've been in consultation with the BCA. They've also been talking to the ATF about that. So if we need to revise that definition, I know that there's openness to do that. In addition, I'll just note too that in the Fargo shooting, a binary trigger was used in that case as well. So we want to get this right and we want to get the language right, and we're certainly open to doing that. So with that, I will move on now and you can give us closing remarks, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and committee members. Lead Novotny, thank you for that. I've been doing my best to research and to understand that so that we can write legislation and pass legislation that is accurate and that actually does what we intended to do. When I've been at the range, admittedly a terribly amateur, I've pulled the trigger and it's released and then I move on feeling relatively proud of myself for not causing any damage. And so I appreciate your expertise on that subject. It's always better to collaborate and get things right. A lot has been said about this bill, so a long closing narrative isn't necessary. But I want to look at each of you, and I want to thank you for handling this discussion the way that you have, for honoring my promise to my community that this would not be only about that tragedy. You've handled it really well. I'm deeply grateful. Thank you so much for hearing this bill.
All right, and with that, I renew the motion and lay over House File 2609 as amended. Next, we have, let's see, Minority Leader Damuth. I think I saw you back there earlier. All right, so the next bill is House File 3757. I will move to lay over House File 3757. Welcome to the committee, Leader Damuth. Please explain your bill to us.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members of the Public Safety Committee. It's an honor to be before you with House File 3757. What I would like to do is I will just give you a little background on what House File 3757 does. This would increase the penalty to a felony for swatting. And we know that swatting is something that can lead to deadly results. I want to make sure that everyone understands that is listening. I'll give you a definition of swatting, and that is where a person would place an emergency call and report a serious but fictitious emergency. It could be a bomb threat, it could be murder, hostage situation, and that is with the intent of prompting an emergency response of law enforcement or fire or emergency medical service personnel. And what that does is that puts those first responders at risk. It puts anyone that may be in that home at risk. And we know that where there is risk and it is a fictitious crime, that is something that we want to increase the penalty for. We also know that swatting would divert our first responders, our law enforcement and emergency personnel away from what could be a true incident. And so we want to just increase this, but it will be very narrowly focused. This is increasing the crime, increasing the penalty for these five categories. It would be for an elected official. It would be for a judge as defined, a prosecuting attorney, an employee of a correctional facility, or a peace officer. And with that, Chair Moeller, that is my bill, and I would be open to questions.
All right, thank you. And I don't think you have a testifier.
I do not.
All right, any members of the public who wish to testify on this? Not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. I'll just note, we requested a fiscal note, and we're still awaiting that.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Yes, we did.
All right, discussion. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Lee Damuth, for bringing this. This does put public safety at risk because they get ramped up, but it also puts the public when these calls happen. So I appreciate you bringing this forward and the list of people that you listed off that's been happening in our community. So thank you.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And I'd like to thank you as well, Leader Damuth, for this bill. I agree with what Witte has said, and I think we need to do work to protect those who protect us, and this is one way to do that. I'm carrying a bill that does something similar to make sure that we're taking care of folks who have these very important roles in our society. So I just want to say thank you.
Great. Anything further? No. Oh, sorry. Couldn't see you behind this. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I hope we're okay on time for me to say this, but this just makes me think about how, sorry to get all philosophical, Leader Damuth, but how precious our democracy is. And I kind of view this as protecting those who protect us, and also just how the folks that are listed here, and of course, there's so many people who do such important work. But I kind of have that on my mind as part of the process today about the process of democracy, and it's messy and it's challenging, and we need to make sure that we do it together. And to the extent that somebody is having this kind of response to these folks, we want to make sure to recognize how dangerous and it is, both for the individuals involved and kind of more broadly as well. So yeah, thank you, Leader Damuth, and thanks, Chair.
Representative Hollins.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Minority Lead Damuth. I think this is a really good bill. It definitely is necessary. And the only thing that I have a slight critique about is I notice it includes prosecutors, but not public defenders. I'm a lawyer, but most of the people I know that I've worked with are private criminal defense attorneys who make enough money to barricade themselves and really, interesting and safe ways, whereas public defenders don't have the resources to do that. And so I wonder if there was a particular reason why public defenders weren't included in this, but prosecutors were.
Leader Damon.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Representative. There was no particular reason for not having them there. I'm always open to discussion on it. This is a great starting point to improve safety on those elected officials, the others that we have listed, and then also our law enforcement and first responders.
Agreed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further? All right. Not seeing anything further. So closing remarks, Leader Damuth.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, for giving me the opportunity to hearing this bill. I want to make sure that members do know this is a bipartisan bill. There, we've had another representative sign on, it is appreciated. I appreciate the comments and having the opportunity to sit firsthand in your committee this morning. I appreciate all of the work that is done by this committee at this time. Thank you.
So thank you, and I will renew the motion and lay over House File 3757. Thanks again. And then we have two Representative Nash bills, and we're going to start with House File 310. Representative Nash, I will move that House File 310 be placed on the General Register. And then you also have the DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment? Would you like me to explain the amendment? Your choice.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. House File 310 is, I think we've been working on this for 3 years, Madam Chair, I believe, maybe at least 2 years. So House File 310 is a bill that is a reaction to a situation that happened in the city of Victoria and has happened actually in many communities. And the bill, as I drafted it, was an effort to make a greater list of criterion for the placement of level three sex offenders into neighborhoods. And the chair and I worked together, and I do want to say thank you so much, because the amendment that is before us today makes the bill better, makes it stronger, and I'm grateful for the existence of it and would encourage us to amend it into the bill.
All right. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. All right, so your bill as amended is before us. Representative Nash, if you'd like to explain it.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee. So House File 310, as I had alluded to when we were amending the amendment in, is a reaction to a situation that happened in the city of Victoria. I have with me today a testifier who lives in the city of Victoria, but here's the short version of what happened. A level three sex offender was deemed eligible for placement in a community. And the community that was chosen, the city of Victoria, the neighborhood that my testifier lives in, had 728 children at the time living in that community. The placement of that level three sex offender, his offense was that he had committed sexual crimes against children, and in court assessment before it was released, it was noted in his file that he was he would sexualize the voices of children. And my supposition, and the supposition of many people in the community, was that this was the wrong place to place this individual person. And I've said on a number of occasions, everybody has a right to live somewhere, but not every somewhere is the right place. And that's what we're trying to fix with this bill. And my testifier is really the voice of his community. We talked about this a lot, and I will let him introduce himself, Madam Chair, and then we can proceed further from there.
All right, that sounds good. So I believe your testifier is Zach Hustad. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
All right. First off, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm Zach Hustad. I'm a father of three children. I have a 16-year-old daughter. I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I have a 10-year-old son. I'm here today on behalf of the local citizens of Victoria, Minnesota, but I also want you to know that I'm representing every child in the state of Minnesota. I'm here for the kids that don't have a voice, the parents that don't know that they can have a voice. That's what this means to me. That's what it means to the community. And that's what the tenacious determination is that I have on behalf of our state to partner with each of you and not give up. All right. What happened in our community was a travesty. This person, Matthew Van Hecke, is a wolf. And he was put in the middle of 728 children that fit the target profile. And that number of 728 isn't the collective number of children in the community. It's the collective number of children that fit the target profile. Okay? And everything in our community dug our heels in. And it's not because we're some suburban differentiation in the community. We're just ones that dug in and fought back. And when we did this, we're like, we're going to fight for everyone. We're going to make this so that every community has the opportunity to have a voice, to figure out how do we put extra guardrails in place to give the Department of Corrections the tools and the language to pause, think, and add common sense to situations like this. And I'm going to tell you what the common sense means. So, common gatherings. The bus stop was directly outside of this person's house. Okay, think about that. Your kids are going to go to school, they're going to get on the bus stop, and it's directly from me to the speaker's chair of where this person's driveway was. The walking path that every family in this new community would go on, this was the route in the front of the house and in the back of the house. In the back of the yard was a skating pond. Well, that doesn't seem like a big deal. No big deal, right? Because in the summer, it's just wet. But what is a playground in the state of Minnesota when it gets cold? A pond. You throw a goalie net on it, and you have families that run electricity out to it. They hang their lights in it. Like, it's a permanent communal gathering spot. And in that one block, right, in this community, there's a pond, there's a marsh, and there are 65 children that was their backyard that it ruined. And this wolf sexualized the voices of those children. I find that unacceptable. And I told everyone that I would fight to help change this. Because when you live in a community like that, in that backyard, and you have a wolf that when they hear it, it takes them to a different spot, of a horrible spot. And I had to ruin the nativity of my children. And I hope that none of you ever have to do this. You have to look at your child and say, hey, there's a wolf in the neighborhood. And then you have to say, they're like, well, what does that mean? And you have to tell your daughter, and you have to take that innocence from them and say, this guy, if you see him, you have to run away. And then they ask you why. Because he was allowed to live. He was allowed to walk around. And this guy mentally got to live rent-free in 728 children's heads. And so we talk about mental health. We talk about mental scars, and we talk about impact to future generations. There could be a case study done on what the Department of Corrections was unable to do and prevent. And it wasn't from a lack of effort from our community. There were people that poured their blood, heart, and tears into trying to fight against this simple thing of, please don't let it allow to be here. I sat down personally with the head of the Department of Corrections.
Houston, I have to, when people saw, we didn't get your name in advance, and you would
have
been
told. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Okay, I jumped right in.
You would have been told 2 minutes, and I wanted to get your full story. And I think
I'm Zach Husted. Yeah. I'm a resident of Victoria, Minnesota. I'm a veteran of this United States of America. I served 12 years in the Air Force with 4 tours to the Middle East. I work full time in the medical device industry, and I'm a small business owner.
Yes.
And I'm a proud supporter of our communities.
So thank you. Thank you for your service, actually, to our country, and thank you for your testimony as well. I want to make sure that we have a full chance to discuss this bill. We also have another Representative Nash bill after this. So
I'm sorry.
Passionate. No worries. It's all right. So I just need to ask if there are any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill. I'm not seeing any, and we can move to member discussion. But first, Representative Nash, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, just to clarify why we have these enhanced definitions, and you and I did work on this. The Department of Corrections, when I met with them trying to intervene on behalf of my constituents, said, well, we don't necessarily have a way or a list or any rationale that we can preclude that person from being located there. And so we took them at their word, and thankfully the chair and I worked together to come up with some clarifying language to say, okay, if these things are present, then they have to be considered in the placement of a level 3 sex offender. So we heard from the Department of Corrections as to why they couldn't, and here's now a bill before us that does provide for those vehicles to be used in the placement of a level 3 sex offender. So I just wanted to make sure we did that before we went on to member questions.
All right, yeah, member questions. And Mr. Husted, you can go back to your seat, please, and we'll call you back down if anybody has a question for you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share.
Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. Your testifier said a perfect word, a wolf. These are people that prey on children, and that should not be okay by anybody. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm glad to be a co-author on it, and we should definitely continue diving into this and finding where those loopholes are, finding where those shortcomings are, and working to address it. Thank you.
Further member discussion? I had a comment, too, I was just going to make. You know, there is a challenge. I mean, level 3 offenders,
are coming back into our communities and they need a place to live, and we have challenges with housing for all people, especially people who have formerly been incarcerated. And I think this is an important issue, and it's an important bill because the current language said that take into consideration the proximity to schools without any consideration if that was even a risk factor for that particular person. So I really like how we've narrowed that. And if it's a school because it's children, then other areas where there might be a lot of children, you know, should be at least taken into consideration when they're looking at placement. But I just wanted to highlight that we know that this is an issue and that people need a place to live. And we're not trying to exclude people that need a place to live from living in our state. But we also want to set them up for success if they have family members that they can live with or be successful. Sometimes that's part of the equation too. But I like the approach of how with the language now, it's really narrowing it down to if that's a particular risk factor for that person. So, but I just wanted to be clear that this is an issue that we need to collectively address. The housing issue related to all people, but especially people who have formerly been incarcerated. Did you have a comment on that, Representative Nash?
I'll just close in the interest of time. And as I had said, Madam Chair and committee, everybody deserves to live somewhere. It's just not that everywhere is the right place. And I don't think that any of us disagree that this was a bad situation, and we want to prevent that. And I know that we've all heard about these things. Some of our other members have had placements that just it doesn't work. So in many respects, we're preventing potential failures for that person who's been put back into a neighborhood from being tempted and being given an opportunity to reoffend. So that's going to lower that, hopefully. But also just to give the Department of Corrections a checklist of things that they can use to say, okay, this person meets these criteria, so let's find somewhere else. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you. My personal thanks to you personally for working with me on this. I'm grateful, and I hope that we can get this to the floor and that we can get it calendared and we can get it passed into law.
Thank you. I'll renew the motion that House File 310 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. And Representative Nash, the final bill we have is House File 4793. I will move that House File 4793 be placed on the General Register. I don't see an amendment to this one, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This one will not be as easy for me to present. So 4793 is a bill that has two areas of principal change to the mandatory reporter law. Then I wanted to thank Representative Pinto for working with me on this. The changes are in lines 2.1 through 2.4, and then again in 2.29 and 2.30. If you all read, and I hope you have, if you haven't, I would encourage you to read the Star Tribune article called In Harm's Way, where there were conversations around mandatory reporting and some of the failures that we've seen. In that article, there is a specific example of a mandatory reporter that brought a report to their management, and that the management effectively made it go away improperly. And as a result, people suffered. The change in the bill, namely around lines 2.1, says that a corporation, school, nonprofit organization, or religious organization may not have policies, written or otherwise, to prevent the discouragement of mandatory reports. That's an important distinction that we need to make sure gets put into law, because we don't want somebody who is a mandatory reporter in good faith saying, I just saw this and I know that this happened, and then somebody in the chain of command higher up from them like, it's okay. Let's just make this go away. Nobody wants the trouble. Nobody wants the angst. Let's just shuffle this off. And as you just saw with the previous bill, oftentimes we do bills for our communities. Oftentimes we do things because that's what we believe in, either as Republican or Democrat or whatever. But sometimes we do bills because it's very, very personal. And here's where I have a hard time getting through the rest of the bill. A couple Thursdays ago, you heard me talk about on the floor my childhood as an abused kid. What I didn't share at the time was that a lot of the failure around my experience with abuse was the breakdown and failure of mandatory reports.
And I was failed in a couple of different ways. I'll share the first one with you, that one of my teachers, who I dearly love and keep in contact with today, was a brand new teacher, and she saw a lot of indications that I had been getting abused at home. You know, you're third grade and you're just playing around, and but teachers are watching and teachers notice what's going on. And she brought a report to the principal saying that Jimmy Nash, and she called me that, and you do not get to. but she said that he's being abused, and it's very clear. The principal made it go away. And I took more beatings. A lot. You've heard me talk about the number of times that I was hospitalized. 8 times. And that's where we get to the part of the other part of the mandatory reporter breakdown. And that was my mom. Who, I got him. I got the Kleenex. My mom was director of nursing at the hospital that I would be taken to when my father would beat me with a bat or an axe handle or his fists or a broom handle broken across my face. And my mom covered it up. Mandatory reporter just made it go away. And you know, as you go through life and you leave the house, you try to make sense of things, and eventually an opportunity presents itself that you just want answers. And a couple of years ago, my mom and I were attending my nephew's wedding, and I was tasked with driving mom back to the airport. And I don't know why, but it just occurred to me to ask. And I asked my mom, I said, Ma, you were a mandatory reporter, right? And she said, oh, yes. Yes, I saved so many people, so many women, so many children from abusive men, and just saved them from bad situations. And as I'd said the other day, Chair Pinto, I thought, well, the next question that I want to ask can never be unasked if I go forward with it. But I did. And I said, well, Mom, why didn't you save me? And there was a long, long pause. And the worst answer in the world is what I got back. And she said, well, I guess I just figured you could take it. So for 17 years of my life, I got the hell kicked out of me. And the people who were supposed to stand up and stop it, one tried and one just didn't bother to try. And the bill today would give us another tool to make sure that that doesn't happen, so that the children that were mentioned in here or the next Jimmy Nash don't have to go through this, because we tighten some language up and we make it harder to be irresponsible or negligent or have somebody above you say, no, we're not going to do this because it's uncomfortable and it might make our organization look bad. And, you know, I rock the boat, and I know that's news to a lot of you. I will fight on this one until I'm done being a legislator. Our children are precious. And as the father of six, I would stand in the way of anything that would hurt my kids. And I would ask you to stand beside me when that didn't happen for me. I'll stop now.
Representative Nash, I just want to say that I'm really grateful for you sharing your story and for presenting this bill, and that I'm really sorry that all of that happened to you as a child. It's not okay. And appreciate your advocacy to protect children in your role as a legislator. So thank you for that. Do we have any member discussion? No, Vice Chair Feist. We're actually over already by a minute, so go really fast.
Very long philosophical question. Just kidding. I just wanted to thank you so much for bringing this bill. This was something that I had been interested in looking into. A good friend of mine is a social worker, and I just kind of hit a wall, and I was like, where do you go with something so important and complicated? And this is just so important and great. So thank you for bringing this important bill.
All right. Did you have any closing remarks?
In the interest of time, I'll just say thanks, and I would ask for your help to make it more difficult for people to avoid their responsibility, and so that we can protect the next Jimmy Nash. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 310, nope, that's the wrong bill, sorry. What's our bill number? I'll renew the motion that House File 4793 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you. And members, we will see you again tomorrow morning. With that, we are adjourned.